Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to History Rage, the podcast where we invite the history community to release all their pent-up frustrations. The podcast where myth and misconception is crammed into a chastity belt and given a good cold shower. I am your regular host, Paul Bavel, and I'm flying solo tonight because that stiffest of upper lips, Kyle Glover, is not particularly well. So from both of us here, get well, Kyle. But this week, dear Ragers, it's the centenary! The centenary! 100 episodes! And I can't quite believe two middle-class white guys could just take over history like this. So thank you to everyone who's been with us from episode 1. And if you joined us at episode 99, well, welcome aboard. But loyal followers, this week we are going back to the prim and proper world of the Victorians and lifting the lid on the seedier side, as we are joined by author, sex historian, host of the Betwixt the Sheets podcast, and self-confessed blonde bombsight, Kate Lister. Kate, welcome to History Rage.
Hello, Paul. Thank you so much for inviting me on.
You are welcome. We have been trying to get you here ever since we started this podcast. We had a target list. We've got 8 out of 10 so far. But you're finally here. But yeah, I've read The Curious History of Sex. I absolutely loved it. My good lady wife told me I kept having to put the book down because I kept sniggering. It is the finest researched total smut I have ever read. It was an absolute simple joy. And if you're going to write another one, please continue to write it in that style. That was absolute. And if you can hit the middle-aged 50-year-old white guy market, you have got that nailed.
Oh, Paul, thank you. It was so much fun to write. I was really lucky with Unbound. They said, we'd like you to write a book about the history of sex. And then they signed the contract. They're like, right, well, we'll see you in a year. And there was just I was like, I don't know what you want me to write, though. I don't know what am I doing? And there was just like to just go away and do it. And it kind of came out like that, and I really enjoyed it, and I made myself laugh, like really tragic laughing at my own jokes, but I'm glad that I seem to have found my tribe, other people who also thought these things are funny.
That's how I say I loved it, and as I mentioned before we started recording, I really loved your use of slang and then the year that it came out. And as I recall, I don't think you repeated one either as well. There's like a good 600 years of smut easily there.
I don't think I did. Going through the edits, I remember I caught a couple that I'd used twice, but I was really trying to get as many as I could. And it's actually quite difficult because, like, you can't just like lob any old slang word in there. It's got to be the right. It's got to make the sentence funnier. And the sound of the word and the type and how it's being used. So that it was actually quite a labor intensive process that I was trying to put all of the random slang in it.
Yeah, it's like, which knob gag do I use?
Yeah. Like, oh, I've used battering ram, and I've used pork wand, and I've used, and like, you're going back and back and back.
It was an absolutely excellent read. And as well as hitting me with the book as well, my good lady wife actually did her master's at Victorian Studies at Trinity as well. I don't think you crossed swords with her. I think she was under Jane.
Yes.
I have to confess, I turned up to her graduation with the express intention of meeting you rather than...
Oh, no. Did she graduate?
It was a couple of years ago now. It was that graduation that they did under COVID restrictions.
Oh, gutted.
Yeah.
Oh, well, huge congratulations to her anyway.
Absolutely.
How anyone graduated under those circumstances is beyond me.
With distinction, I may hasten to add, and with the prize winning as well.
Clever.
Oh, she is the clever girl of us. I'm just this thick guy that talks on the podcast. So could you just give us a kind of like brief insight into, you know, I've read excellent books. I've seen some really eye-opening TikTok videos. Can you give us an insight into your history as a historian and how you landed in this particular field?
And it's weird, isn't it? I don't know if anybody starts out thinking I want to be a sex historian. If you go back and if you look at my PhD, I don't know why you'd want to, but they're all a matter of public record. It's actually on Victorians writing about the medieval period in order to try and understand their own time and their own sexuality. It's not about whores of yore or sex work at all, but I did what a lot of people do when they're halfway through a PhD, is they find something much more interesting, which was the history of sex work and smut and naughty things. But I was committed by that point, and my supervisors kept having to be like, no, King Arthur, stay focused. So then as soon as the PhD was done, I was allowed to sort of go off the chain a little bit in my postdoc. And that was where I really started to explore the history of sexuality. But what really kicked it into overdrive was when I started the Twitter account, Whores of Yore, because that suddenly, I'd started that to try and share the funnier things that I kept turning up. And it grew and it grew and it grew. And then that became what I was known for. And the more that was what I was known for, that's what people wanted. So the fact that I've got a book on Victorian material culture, no one gives a shit about that. Where's the slang? This is really boring, Kate. So that, and also that's what I really enjoy. And I found a niche with doing serious history and talking about the history of sexuality, but making it funny and making it accessible as well, because that's what I really love. Academics are amazing people, but they can be quite an odd bunch. I do like people that laugh at it as well.
Yeah, they can get some very niche things out. I think somebody described it to me as like a history degree is about history people are interested in.
Yes.
A master's is about history that 100 people are interested in, and a PhD is about a thing that only you will ever be interested in.
It's so true. A friend of mine once said that they put a £20 note in their PhD thesis where it was printed out and put in the library, and they went back and checked it 15 years later and it was still there. Nobody reads this stuff.
And you have to pay so much money to get it put in there as well.
I think I honestly think that it's more a test of endurance than it is actual intellectual rigor. It's just like, are you mad enough to actually see this thing through for like 3 to 5 years of being on your own in a dusty library, obsessing about this one thing that's getting smaller and smaller and smaller, and literally nobody, not even your family, know what on earth it is that you do all day long. And honestly, people go bonkers. It's like a proper Hunger Games thing. People lose the plot and they drop out because it's too weird. It's such a weird process.
It was footnoting that got me. I think when Becky was going through having to kind of Harvard style footnote. Why?
That is a test of anybody's patience. I just got a flashback when you said that. I was just like, oh,
sorry.
No, the footnotes are going to get me again. Or like the indexing and just it all. And God bless the people that really understand it, but they're the ones there going that, no, you've got to have the full stop after the parenthesis, and there needs to be two. Oh, my God. God, it's all online. Can't I just put a hyperlink in now? No.
Yeah, because you can't link from that one thing in the library that nobody is reading.
That nobody will ever read, not even your family and the people who love you the most.
Well, we're... If we're going from the things and the people that you love the most and the things that do frustrate you within history, let's kick into our history rage question, the classic history rage question then. So would you please tell patient and somewhat over frustrated mob out there, what is the one thing you wish everyone would just stop believing?
It's this idea that Victorian people were just inherently frumpy and hated sex, and that no one was having sex, and that the people who were only having sex once a week with the lights out and their pyjama tops on, and that the Victorians were just horrified by all things sexy. That is just not true, and we are all the living, breathing, walking proof that at least some people in the Victorian periods were having quite a lot of sex. They are a really, really complicated bunch, but they are really, they are so mucky. Like, they've got this very forward-facing image of very prim and proper and buttoned up to the neck and got your staves on, and oh my God, you can't look at table legs, that's too offensive, except that wasn't true either. But this is a group of people that invented photographic pornography, that invented the first porn films, that mass-produced pornographic literature. These people were obsessed with sex. They're obsessed with sex. And if, even if that thing about the table legs was true, that is not indicative of a group of people that have no issues with sex. It's like, if you can't look at a table's leg without thinking, oh my God, sex, you have a major problem.
You're absolutely obsessed if that's...
Wow, you are thinking about sex a lot, if that's what you're doing. So that far from being repressive and prudish, these were people that talked about sex all the time, but they often spoke of it in a way that it was like, I'm not thinking about sex. Are you thinking about sex? Who's thinking about sex? Not me. I'm not thinking about sex. Right. So nobody here is thinking about sex. There was this weird, but now everybody's thinking about sex. That's what the Victorians were like.
That is an incredible description there. It's really, right. Deep breath, Paul. Okay. So, can you give us some examples then of Victorian individuals and groups who kind of challenged and operated outside that, what we would consider that Victorian norm that very much isn't? So that kind of the individuals and groups that really show that.
They are there. They are often underground groups because of this sort of rather surface level prudery, and because there were laws and things in place and they risk quite heavy censor. But sexual liberation and people fighting for better sexual liberation were all around. I think one of my favorite Victorians, and she's an American Victorian, but we won't hold that against her. Mm-hmm. Her name was Ida Craddock. She's not very
good
well
name.
Known. Very excellent name.
Yeah.
Right? If you're going to write about sex, your last name should be Craddock. Just should be. And she was born in Philadelphia in the mid-19th century, and she died really early into the 20th century. But she wrote about sexual freedom and sexual liberation, and she wrote all these books. And she was really into spiritual sexuality, and she thought she was married to a ghost called Soph, and she used to brag that her and this ghost were having sex so loud that, like, the neighbours would complain. So she's a bit out there, but she would write. She wrote basically sex manuals for couples together, and she wrote really graphic descriptions of how a husband can pleasure his wife on their wedding night, including descriptions of, like, sit down on the penis and then twist it around like you're a corkscrew. And she...
I'll have to adjust the way I'm sitting now.
I don't think it's the best sex tip, Ida, but, I mean, you know, you do you. But she wrote lots and lots of these texts, and she was constantly and banned and subject to censorship, and her work was seized, and she got sentenced to prison eventually for publishing this stuff. And it all became so much for her that she took her own life at the age of only 45 rather than go back to prison. So it's a really sad end for her. But she, like, it just, nothing would stop this woman. She just published, and it's so mad when you're reading it. It was just this American woman from Philadelphia in the late 19th century giving penis tips. That's just not what you think of. But there she was, absolute mad trailblazer, and her ghost sex buddy.
Yeah, so the idea of watching the entity was actually a Victorian idea.
She was well into it. She wrote quite graphically about the sexual relations she was having with this ghost. She was a real fan of something that was known as Dionism, after the goddess Diana, who was the goddess of virgin. That it was a sexual practice where you would basically have sex but without ejaculating. So it's like probably neo-tantrics and tantricism, and that the idea that you have sex but you don't ejaculate. She was a big fan of that. She thought it was all about building up energy, and it was called Dianism at the time, and she wrote about that quite a lot.
Okay, so moving from individuals and groups then, you mentioned like laws, prisons, centres and things like that. So how did Victorian society and Victorian law view and discuss topics like sexuality, gender roles, relationships, extramarital sex?
It was quite punitive. Victorian law is you get a real sense of whack-a-mole. What's happening here is like somebody will do something, cause a scandal, and there won't be a law with which to punish them. And then suddenly, bam, then there'll suddenly be a law in place. A good example of that was two young Victorian men who were cross-dressing and soliciting for sex in the Strand Theatre in London in like the mid-19th century. Mm. They were known as Fanny and Stella. That was their stage name.
Oh, yes.
Yeah? Yes. And you can read all about them. They're incredible. Their story's amazing. But they were arrested, and the law at the time was they could only be charged with conspiracy to commit sodomy. Right, which is a difficult one,
yeah,
because you have to try and prove that you were trying to get somebody else to have anal sex with you. That is actually quite difficult to prove if the people in question are going, nope, right? So they couldn't make the charges stick, so they had to let them go. And then there was a change in the law, the Le Boucher Amendment Act, and that suddenly made anything to do with homosexuality or, it really didn't bother the lesbians that much, but it was about gay men, and it was anything to do with homosexuality was now regarded as a public indecency. And that was the law that got Oscar Wilde, and that was the law that got Alan Turing. So it was punitive, and they could be a nasty bunch of bastards when they wanted to be. A lot of people got quite hurt with this stuff.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned Oscar Wilde there, because as I understand it, he was actually jailed for incitement to sodomy. I think he's the actual charge, am I right? One thing that's always puzzled me, though, is they can get Oscar Wilde for this sort of stuff, and it's that, I think it's that incitement to sodomy that links it to gay men.
Mm.
Because nobody ever seems to touch Ann Lister for this sort of stuff, do they?
There's another myth that goes around, which is that lesbianism never made it onto the law books because Queen Victoria refused to believe that lesbians existed. That's not true. That never happened. However, that there is minutes of the law being discussed, and there is a sense of the lawmakers that, well, don't be so stupid, women wouldn't do such a thing.
They don't get out that much, do they?
Oh, no. What on earth are you talking about? It was this idea, and you can still say it today. Like, if all of my lesbian friends will tell me that, like, they get asked all the time, what do you do? What do you do with each other? It's like this idea that if you don't have a penis, that you're not having sex. What could you possibly be doing? We just braid each other's hair and eat cookie dough. So the lesbians never actually made it onto the law books the same way that gay men did. No, they just weren't. But that doesn't mean that they weren't subject to social stigma, because Ann Lister writes a lot about she gets things thrown at her, she gets abuse hurled at her in the streets, which is really horrible for her. But from a historian's point of view, it's also showing that people knew. Like, it wasn't some big hushed up secret. People were attacking her on the basis of her sexuality. They called her Tom Lister, which was a slang at the time for a lesbian. So although that treatment was horrible, it was happening to her from a historian's point of view. It shows that people were well aware of gay culture and lesbian culture and were willing to attack it as well. But it wasn't as hushed up as we often think that it was.
Yeah, and it's not. You're not getting put inside for that.
No. I mean, there were cases of women being jailed for various things in sort of local parishes. And it was things like they had tried to live as a man. And so I suppose today we might say that was a trans man, or that they'd attempted to marry a woman. There's a couple of cases of that. Mm. But the Le Boucher Amendment Act of, I think it was 1865, I think, that was specifically targeted to men. And the lesbians all just stood in the background going, hee hee. Totally got away with that.
So how did they, you mentioned there sort of like there's other things as well as homosexuality and imprisonment and things like that. What was the Victorian laws doing regards to other expressions of, say, sexual imagery, sexual talk, sexual print?
Well, again, they were playing catch up a lot of the time, because as the Industrial Revolution, it must have been an incredible time to be alive. I mean, beginning of the century, like no one had seen a photograph, and then by the end of it, you've got like film and cinema. Like the speed of change, it was so rapid. And as anybody who is a historian of technology or who just researches technology will tell you, if you can get a technology to have a pornographic use, it's much more likely to get made.
Welcome to the internet.
Yes, see the internet point in case. So, I mean, how soon after Mr. Daguerreotype took his first picture do you think that somebody went, oh, hang on, I know what I could take a picture of? So the Victorians suddenly were dealing with pornography on a scale that had never, ever been precedented in human history. Ever. We've always had pornography, but pornography was, it was the preserve of the rich because books were expensive and you have to be able to read and you have to know where to get them from. Or it was art and artistic. Again, rich. The Victorians were mass producing this stuff and it was more graphic than ever happened before because it was photographs and film. So they're playing catch up all the time and they're passing obscene publication acts. And if you look at Victorian pornography in like the mid 19th century, it's quite graphic. Like it was graphic all the time. And then you hit sort of the mid to late 19th century and you start getting all these weird images when people have got like their pubes rubbed out because it was because that the Obscene Publications Act came in, so that the pictures are suddenly distorted. Like they would just literally scrub them off on the silver plate so you couldn't see any of the details and you can trace it. And then the porn trade moved largely to Paris. So they were constantly playing catch up of what, and then that's difficult as well. What's regarded as obscene, which is a question that we still tackle today, is like, what, when does art stop and obscenity begin? You know, so it's, and that was a question that they were constantly railing with as well. It's like, is Michelangelo's David obscene? No, but this nude picture of a woman, that is obscene. So it caused all kinds of arguments and debates like that. But yeah, they were a very confused and horny bunch of people, the Victorians.
I bet Hansard's going to be an incredible read for those debates, isn't it?
Yes.
I was just thinking as well, if you think Victorian photography, I mean, that takes some time. That suppose you've got to hold for quite a while.
The early stuff, yes, that's true. Like that's, and there's a story that's why people don't smile at Victorian things, but pretty quick they'd managed to get the technology. So it was just that flash and then it was done. The reason that they're not smiling is because they haven't quite worked out what looks like a good picture yet.
Yeah.
And I love them for that. You can see it in the porn as well. Like now when you look at porn or any kind of pictures, actually, it's so stylized. Like if you tell someone to take a selfie, they've got the angle right on their phone, they do the face, they do the pout. And we all know what looks good. But the technology was so new in the 19th century, there's a real sense of they're trying to work out what looks sexy. Like what looks sexy for the first time? You've got to try and stage it. And then you get, there's lots of Victorian photographs where they've brought props in. Like there's little taxidermy dogs and cats. And it's like, what was the conversation? There's one when, like, this nude woman and she's got a bat flying above her, a taxidermy bat. And it's just, there's just a real sense of, like, that they're struggling to work out what works from a visually aesthetic. And I kind of like it as well because often they look like they're having a really good time. They're smiling and they look like they're actually really enjoying the sex. And there's something, even though they're having full penetrative sex, there's something quite sweet about it in a weird way because it doesn't have that quite aggressive and violent thing that modern pornography does. This is kind of like, oh, we're having sex and there's also a taxidermy dog here. And so it's just wonderfully bonkers when you look at it. And I love them for that.
So we've got this mass market kind of pornography and this, for want of a better word, a exposure to sex where you can't just can't avoid it. So are there any significant Victorian figures then that are starting to advocate for more sexual education, more progressive attitudes, you know, beyond just in sex in general, going outside, say, the homosexuality or the LGBTQ side of things in Victorian England that are just kind of, we need to get more progressive about this. This is perfectly normal.
You do. You get sort of trailblazers that pop up all the way through. But really, when things start coalescing and becoming a proper movement, is sort of to the later 19th century when you get the early sexologists. And the move to more sexual liberation and more, look, we have to stop viewing this as just something awful, guys. It is largely born out of science and I suppose the medicalization of sex, because that's one way to do it, isn't it? That's one way to try and destigmatize it and try and say, look, it's no big deal, guys, is to say it's a scientific fact of nature.
Well, so I learned about it in biology class.
So we still do that, don't we? But so you have people like Havelock Ellis, who was a pioneering sexologist who collected stories about people's sex lives and wrote about masturbation. And he was one of the first people to talk about homosexuality in terms of it just being a natural state, not a horrendous moral inclination. And then you've got other people like Kraft von Ebbing and him writing about, and Freud, obviously, and all of his mates. But there's a real effort to try and understand sex from a scientific point of view. And they held a bit more credibility than my mate Ida, who was shagging a ghost, because they were all white men and they all had titles and they all had books and they all were very, very privileged. So they were easier to listen to. But then you've got people like Mary Stopes towards the end of the 19th century into the 20th century. And she's such a difficult figure because she did some amazing work, but she was also a massive eugenicist dickhead. And that's like really just like, oh, damn it. Mary, really? But she wrote Married Love precisely to try and educate people about sex, not as porn, not as, you know, titillation, but a genuine effort to try and help people understand this is what sex is and this is how, where babies come from, and these are your options to not have the babies. So she's such a difficult figure because that work she did was amazing, but a lot of the reasons that she was doing that was about eugenics. Damn it. But I know it's difficult, but she was part of the birth control movement, and that was about sexual education as well.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Is there any truth to this thing that you hear then, and it was mentioned by Kit Chapman on one of our earlier episodes, that they have this idea that if you could only get pregnant if you liked it.
that was a source of some contention. So this was an idea that's been knocking around since the ancient world, which was that a woman has to orgasm in order to conceive, in order to become pregnant. Now that when you first hear it, you go, yes, that sounds quite progressive. I'll have some of that. Brilliant. But there are actually trials and prosecutions for rape and sexual assault where the defense argue that because the victim became pregnant, she must have had an orgasm. Therefore, she must have consented to this and enjoyed it. So there's a real dark side to it. But that isn't that isn't universally accepted in 19th century medical literature. You do get people contesting it. But even the fact that it's being spoken about, even the fact that there are people there going, I don't think so, lads, means that it's still a view that held some sway, enough at least for people to have to say, I'm not sure that's right. But yeah, that was a very widely held belief for a long time.
Yeah, and if it's it's a view that's cropping up in court, so it must be something that, I mean, you know, I work in making legal arguments myself, and sometimes we will go in for anything we think we could get past a judge, but there must have been sort of core belief in there for a lawyer to stand up in front of a jury and go, well, clearly, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, well, thank you. So we've got a question now that is submitted by one of our Patreon subscribers, one of our own history enragers. So Simon Clark, thank you very much. And Simon asks, was there a variation in attitudes to sex between social classes?
Oh, Simon, that is a good... Does Simon mean, like, that people of different classes having sex with one another, or does he mean that, like, their social attitudes were different between different classes?
I read that as being the attitude to sex amongst the working classes is different to the attitude to sex amongst the middle classes.
Okay, yeah. Yes, there was. There was. But ultimately, they were all an absolute bunch of dirtbags, I think. So the upper-class Victorians tended to view working-class people as being very much like a sort of, oh, my God, these absolute animal-like heathens. And they had this real idea that they were hotbeds of sexual immorality and vice. And if you were a Victorian rich person, you could actually pay to go what was called slumming around the slum areas like Whitechapel to see where the paws lived. Just to go like on poverty safari and witness this. So
they still do that in some countries now.
Well, I mean, we still do that on television, don't we? Like all of Benefit Street and all that, you know, Channel 5 documentaries about, you know, 10 kids and I'm on benefits and all that stuff. That's the same thing the Victorians were doing when it's like, oh my God. So we still do that. So the upper classes certainly look down on the lower classes. And I think that the working classes had a lot more freedom and agency. And I'll be very careful when I say that because it must have been pretty crap to have been a working class person in a slum in London. But they had more freedom and agency than the upper classes in some ways. So if you're an upper class Victorian woman, you were expected to just kind of sit at home in a proper Jane Austen style-y. You would sit there and you might go to your friend's house and they'd come to your house. And then you might go to someone else's house and then they'd come to your house. And then you go to someone else's house and you'd just talk a little bit and then you'd get married. But and so that was the real kind of like, that's what you're supposed to if you're a good upper class girl. Working class people, they couldn't afford to do that shit. They could like, they can't afford to just sit around drinking tea. They've got to go and work and earn money and get in there and live their lives. So they had more, I suppose, social agency in some ways than a restrictive upper class. But that certainly doesn't mean that it was that they weren't subject to some pretty awful social stigma at the same time. I don't know. I'd rather be rich, actually. I was just thinking about that. You'd always rather be rich because even if you just had to sit in a house so nobody thought that you were sexually immoral, it would be a big house and that would be infinitely better than being skinned.
Infinitely better than waking up in Flower and Dean Street and having to go and, you know, go around being cockney for money.
Yes, yeah. And, you know, and but then you could say, oh, but, you know, I can go to the pub and a posh woman cut. No, that's not going to cut it, is it? It's still rubbish. I think that there's different social expectations. And you can see that there's a lot of hypocrisy that comes around with it. Like you get, it's horrible when you read cases of women that have found themselves pregnant and abandoned and they've lost their job because what's happened was they went into domestic servitude and the master of the house or his sons has had sex with her or forced them to have sex with them, got pregnant, and now she's just cast out. You see that story cropping up quite a lot. And I'm not sure what stories these guys were telling themselves to make that okay, other than that she was poor, so nobody cared and it didn't matter as much.
Yeah.
Which is sad.
We do still have there's an element of that now because it's a sector of society that I work at and you do seem to get that attitude from a lot of people that, oh, if you can't afford to live, maybe you should stop having children and things like that.
And, yes.
You know.
I think that we still live in the shadow of a lot of Victorian social attitudes. Like the Victorians were very big on something that they called the deserving poor and the undeserving poor. So they would split the poor up into two categories. One was the deserving poor. So that was like your proper heartbreak tragedy, a soldier back from the war, but he couldn't find work and he's down on his luck and he has a wife to feed and a baby. And we all feel super sorry for him. And then he can get money and help. The undeserving poor were the people that they thought should be able to work and weren't working. So therefore they deserve to be poor and they just deserve to be punished and they had to go to the workhouse. It was a brutal, horrible system. And I think we still do that, don't we? There's still a sense of blaming people for their own poverty and their own misfortune and for not doing poor properly,
for not being grateful for your employment and support allowance or your universal credit.
For not performing poverty to the way that people would like them to. And you get that every time some daft posh twat says, oh, I don't know what everyone's moaning about with these food banks. I've just made porridge for 30p. And it's just, oh, shut up, Kevin. You absolute moron.
So how are the middle classes fitting into this? Because I've always viewed the Victorian period as being the golden age of the prognosing middle class do-gooder that screws everybody's life up that they touch.
I have spoken to historians before that have made the argument that if you were mega, mega, mega rich, right, like the top of the aristocracy, and if you were right at the bottom living in a pond, like with nothing at all, you actually had quite a lot of freedom because no one really cared what you did. If you were super rich, you could do what the hell you like because who's going to stop you? And if you're living in a pond, fair play. But like these people in the middle do become super moral arbiters because they are trying to move away from the person in the pond and try and get towards this super rich person. And they are the ones that have these extremely tightly wound Victorian morals, and you will not do that. I would never think of doing that in a month of Sundays. And I have heard that argument, and I think that that's quite convincing because I reckon there's always been a middle class, but the Victorians, it really exploded into its own thing in the 19th century when we got things like leisure time, when we had weekends and city gardens and things that people can go and see, and this trains to the seaside, exactly, and a holiday, and people can start earning careers, and for the first time really ever people can be born in a pond, but if they can, there's actually mobility, social mobility, that they could if they just worked really, really hard, probably
I got born differently.
But there was new money. We'd never had new money before. Before it was just like, oh, shut up. You know, you're born in a pond, stay in a pond. But the Victorians, you had social mobility. You had new industries. The north of England was suddenly alive with manufacture and trade in ways that it hadn't been before. It was a real radical shakeup. And I have heard a lot of historians argue that it was primarily the middle and upper class, the bourgeoisie, who were these very, very straight-laced, puritanical, I don't think we'll be doing that, sunshine, put that tablecloth over those table legs, that it was them. And I think there's something in that.
How are they using kind of sex and sexuality and that morality to advance their own cause?
Sex is a great social power and control. The way it's deployed is usually through shame, is when you've got like good sexual morals, that in itself is a very controlling notion of what is good sex and what is bad sex, what is good sexual behavior and what is bad sexual behavior. And we still have that today. We still have it today. If you're going to insult a woman, you call her a slag or a slut. You might know nothing about her sexual history whatsoever, but that's the go-to accusation, because what we're saying is that you are sexually immoral in a way that I don't find acceptable. And once you've got that in place, it's really easy to judge somebody's character with that. And the Victorians do that a lot. And a lot of it is levied at women, but it's at men as well. And then it starts to filter down into, well, marriage. Now you have to get married because you can't be having sex outside of marriage. So now you have to get married. And that's quite a strong social mechanism as well. And then you get this nuclear family rising up, and that this is the ideal, and that anything outside of this is suspect and dodgy. So sex and what we think of as good sex, bad sex, illegal sex are very, very powerful agents of social control. Still are.
Yeah, which I would imagine that the Victorian middle class, again, being probably the most controlling demographic, are going to really zero in on that, aren't they? Okay, let's move things to somewhat a little bit more lighthearted now. So this is a thing that you refer to in the book, and particularly as well in the audiobook, had a right good rant about this. So, the Victorian vibrator. We have all seen the claim. So tell us about this and how it is bollocks.
Right. So there is this ongoing myth that the Victorians invented the vibrator that we all know and love today doctors invented it to masturbate their female patients to orgasm, to cure them of hysteria. And that is such a fun myth. It's such a fun story that it has now seeped into popular consciousness and become a half truth. You can still find articles on the internet about it. There have been films made, not documentaries, films made about it, although I have heard it be referenced in a few documentaries, because it's such a fun, silly, mad, bonkers story, isn't it, that the Victorians
Yeah, it's not going to go away.
Right, no, we all love that story. But the thing that that set me off thinking, I just don't think that's true, was how much the Victorians didn't like masturbating. Like, not all of them. I mean, evidently, most people were having a great time with it. But if you read particularly Victorian medical texts, bearing in mind that it was supposed to be doctors who came up with this idea, they are almost universally against masturbation, because they have this idea that if a man masturbates too much, he'll lose too much of his vital essence, his sperm, and he will wither and die slowly. Masturbation becomes terminal to Victorian doctors. And for women...
It's how we all want to go.
Isn't it, right? And women, it's just awful. Like, they probably won't die and wither up. But I did read one Victorian doctor refer to women masturbating as a moral leprosy, which is just like, whoa, steady on. So I was just couldn't. All right. So these are a group of people that think of women masturbating as being moral leprosy. They're not going to invent a vibrator to encourage this. They're just not. That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, they're going to stick to trying to capture her free-floating womb, aren't they?
Yeah, with a butterfly net. So I looked into it, and this is a myth that comes from a book called The Technology of Orgasm by Rachel Maines. And she wrote it in 1999, and she made all these claims. Sorry, 1990, I think. And she made all these claims about how women all throughout history have been masturbated to orgasm to cure hysteria. And there are bits of truth in it, but she's kind of taken like the best bits and twisted it to fit a narrative. And I think even now, by her own admission, she was like, yeah, that probably wasn't right, but sorry about that, guys. But that didn't stop it. It's out there now.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean the Victorians weren't doing some pretty weird stuff. So the first vibrator that gets invented looks it's called a vibrator, but it's not a vibrator you'd use on your genitals. It's just, it's not. It's part of this Victorian pseudoscience technology cures that they came up with, like radium therapy and like electricity therapy. Vibration therapy was supposed to be a really good one. And he was called Granville, the guy who invented it. And it looks like a conker. That's what it looks like. It just looks like a metal string with a kind of a heavy weight on it. And he called it percussing, that you just tap it against the body, just tap, 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 tap. So that's not going to get you off for a start. And he also was very clear that it shouldn't be used on women. Just it was only to be used because obviously we would do something dodgy with it. So it could only be used on men. And then you get the invention of more Victorian vibrators, and you see them, they look like hand whisks. They look like...
Terrifying.
They're terrifying things. They are terrifying things. But when you look at them in action, again, that's not a piece of machinery that you're going to want near your clitoris. Like, it means it might be some people's kink, but
It would shear it off.
It would shear it off, right? So, like, let's be sensible about this. But it was an actual massager. It was a proper... That's what they used it for, was to, like, pummel the skin. Now, that doesn't mean that certain mucky people didn't get ideas. And the later versions of this, as you get into the 20th century, have attachments that are probably being put to sexual uses.
Hey, that's where the market is, isn't it?
That's it. So pretty soon, the massager, the vibrator merge, and then that becomes the actual vibrator that we know and love today. And those vibrators were sold as massagers to get round the censorship laws. But the idea that Victorian doctors invented them, and they invented them specifically to give women orgasms because they were so hysterical, no. They were doing weird shit anyway. They didn't need to come up with that. But yeah, that isn't true. No. And shout at anyone who tries to tell you that it is.
Yes, well, we'll just play them this episode again. Or better still, tell them to buy your book.
Yes.
Absolutely. So our last question for the night is actually one that my good lady wife has put forward here. So Okay. Yay, nepotism for History Rage. So given Victorian society's push towards this veneer of morality and all the subsequent tales that we have of Victorians being anything but that moral. Are they hypocrites, or are they just failures in not being able to meet their own high standards?
That's a good question. You can tell she's a historian, your missus. I don't think that they are any more hypocritical than any age throughout history. I think that perhaps they have more extreme and striking examples of it. Like, you know, that they were so, that certain sections were so uptight about sex that they would be, that apparently the word trousers was offensive because it just reminded, trousers reminded you of sex. And, oh my God. But these are also the people that invented porn. So clearly somebody's having sex. But I think, are they any more hypocritical than our own time? Like, really? Mm. Like, if you read the Sunday papers, there's some sex scandal somewhere. Some footballer's been caught in a hotel room doing cocaine off a sex worker or whatever it is that he's up to. And we all sit there and go, oh my God, that is outrageous. That is an awful, awful thing to do, without ever reflectively examining ourselves of, like, have you had sex? Have you once in your life taken drugs? Like, the whole, like, we are very, very quick to condemn people for their sexual behavior and pretend that we don't do these things ourselves. I think we still do that. Perhaps the Philip Schofield recent sex scandal is an example of that, although there probably was some pretty dodgy stuff going on there.
Allegedly.
Right. But that's another good example of just, like, why are we so fascinated with people's sex lives anyway? The Victorians certainly were. Like, is it any interest of ours? But the Victorians were sort of the pioneers of this obsession. So I don't think that they were any more hypocritical than any other era that had gone before, because nobody has got it right. I'm often asked, has there ever been a point in history where we got sex right? When we were just, like, cavorting in a sexual utopia around a bonfire and just having a whale of a time and nobody was being shitty to anyone else?
Ancient Greece.
Well, yes.
Actually, no. When you
see,
think about it, yeah.
That's the thing. Yeah. You'd be tempted, wouldn't you, to go, oh, ancient Greece weren't so bad. Institutionalised paedophilia.
Yeah.
Slaves.
You know, slaves, non-consent. The fact that married women had to be faithful, but married men could do what they like. Yeah.
See, no one's ever got it quite right. I think probably the closest that we've got is our own time, which is terrifying as well as being quite an interesting thought. So I think that the Victorians sort of set themselves up for failure. I think they wanted to be. I think they wanted to be better than they actually were. Because if history will tell us anything, it's that you can't repress sex. You can't. It is like the whack-a-mole. It just comes up in other ways. And the more that you try and stop people thinking about sex, the more they think about sex.
Well, thank you. I just want to throw one other question in there, because we've talked about Victorian society and its obsession with porn. Am I right in thinking that does actually go all the way up to the royal family as well? For all what we think of Queen Victoria, she has a mass porn collection.
I don't know if she has a porn. It wouldn't surprise me. It wouldn't surprise me. One of the things I could tell that she definitely did do was she had a very saucy portrait of herself painted and presented to her husband, Albert. And when you look at it, you go, oh, that's not very saucy. But for the Queen of England, it was mega saucy, right? So she's got
like table legs and everything.
Just look at the ankles on that. She's got like a shoulders bare, and she's got her hair loose, and she's kind of like looking up above her in this kind of like almost like pleasurable ecstasy. And for the time, that was so shocking. So that was like Queen. If she'd had a photograph, she totally would have taken a tit pic and sent it to Albert.
Well. Thank you very much. That was absolutely epic.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
And it's been well worth the 2 years of solid effort we put into trying to get here. And I do hope you will come back. I will. Really do. Oh, dear. Have you had fun?
I've had so much fun. Thank you for inviting me.
You're welcome. Do you feel better for having got
that
off it?
I do feel better. Yes.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Well, ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to know more about this subject, and frankly, who wouldn't? Then you should start by buying and reading the excellent book, The Curious History of Sex, and we will have a link to that in the History Rage bookshop. You can and should also follow Kate on Twitter at Kate_Lister, and that's Kate spelt K8, or connect with her stream of history with the sex industry by following at Whores of Yore. All of those are worth your time. But once again, Kate, thank you very much for coming on to History Rage.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
So, ladies and gentlemen, I do hope you've enjoyed this episode. We would really appreciate any reviews you could leave for us with Apple, Podchaser or Amazon. You can follow us on Twitter at History Rage, or individually, I am at Paul Bavel and Kyle is at Kyle G History. And if you subscribe to us on Patreon, you are really helping us meet the cost of podcasting. Your £5 per month will get you early episodes, entry into all of our prize draws, the invite to put questions to future guests, as Simon has done this week, and of course, the coveted History Rage mug. And you can subscribe at patreon.com/History Rage. Now that is the end of series 10, so we are going to take a couple of weeks off now. We will be back in series 11 and we hope to see you all then. But until then, stay angry. Bye bye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.